Roxanne, you don't have to put on the red light.
When we first came to America, the record company didn't even know that we were on the label. We just showed up. We said, we're here, we're playing, we're on tour. You know, we just thought we'd inform you that we're in town. They say, who signed you? We were signed by the English record company. The American branch knew nothing of it. My brother Ian, who was our agent, he had an agency in New York, and he called them up and said that they were coming over. And they said, but look, Ian, we're not going to be giving them tour support. We're not going to be doing this, and we're not. It was like a list of what they were not going to do for it. We could be together, walking on
the moon. We're a better group than we were that when we made Outlandish Tomorrow. Outlandish Tomorrow has a kind of grotesque, naive charm about it, which is just great. But We Got Out of Blowing is infinitely a better record. Sending out a SOS. My name is Sting, in the studio.
Welcome back. In the studio with the police. I'm Stuart Copeland with Redbeard.
When promoters announced a 30th year anniversary reunion tour in 2007 for the police, the response was overwhelming and unequivocal. Immediate sellouts in every major North American city, requiring multiple nights, and in many of the largest stadium shows. After 15 months touring the world, The Police Reunion ranks as the third largest grossing tour ever. All of this is all the more amazing when you read The Police guitarist Andy Summers' autobiography entitled One Train Later, where he writes about The Police on tour for the first time in America back in 1978 to support their first album, Outlandish Tomorrow, coming to be interviewed by me at a radio station in Memphis, traveling in a station wagon. Depending upon where you read, the eventual success of The Police can be explained as matter-of-factly as this opening assessment in Rolling Stone's Encyclopedia of Rock and Roll, and I quote, "The Police's canny, forward-looking combination of pop hooks, exotic rhythms, blonde good looks, adventurous management, and good timing won the trio a mass following in America and around the world," end quote. Now, as Sally Field's chastened reporter character says in the conclusion of the movie Absence of Malice, that's accurate, but it's not true. No, the tale is much more intriguing. Starting with drummer Stuart Copeland, an American playing in the dying embers of British progressive rock band Curved Air. After a tax debt gig in Newcastle, England, Copeland dropped in on local band Last Exit's set.
The gig had been moved out of the theater because some problems. So they played in a classroom, and the light show was two reading lamps on either side, and they just played at one end of a classroom. And they were kind of a jazz group playing Return to Forever material and stuff like that, and some original stuff, but pretty much derivative stuff. But there was one guy, the bass player, who did about half the singing, and there was a light shining down from heaven, in a neon light over the guy's head, blinking. It's like, this is it.
This guy's going to be a star.
Yeah, I mean, I just recognized, Sting is one person of whom it could be said that success never changed him. He had a swagger when he was broke, starving, and he had one pair of dungarees, and he still owned the world, even way back then.
Yeah.
from November 1978's debut album Outlandos D'Amour, that's The Police with Next to You. I remember the first time I asked band founder Stuart Copeland how he, his older sister, and two older brothers had all been raised in Cairo, Egypt, and Beirut, Lebanon. Stuart averted my gaze and nervously replied, "Oh, my dad was with the State Department." Again, accurate, but not true. Stuart's father was a founding field agent of the CIA, an original Cold War spook. Oldest brother Miles III and older brother Ian had stumbled into band management and booking in London by 1977. Drummer Stuart Copeland figured he'd become chief of police.
Meanwhile, on the other side of town, there was this punk phenomenon happening where there were these smelly dive clubs with these punk groups that could hardly play, but audience going berserk. I mean, it was like a barroom brawl. The minute these bands would kick up, 1, 2, 3, 4, blah, 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 and like the place would erupt in this frenzy. And the band was up to its elbows and arms and legs flying past, you know, the classic punk pogo of 1977. And so I figured this is the world for me. It's just so much more exciting. You know, the gigs, I mean, it was happening, whereas the old fashion scene, every gig we did, we were deeper in debt. Every record we made, we were deeper in, you know, like to work, we would put ourselves in debt. And it was, we were owned by the man. And but this punk thing was completely independent of the music industry. And the kids would just go out there and, you know, beat the hell out of their guitars. And whatever money they got paid by the club owner, which is probably not much, they'd take home and divide up amongst themselves and then be there for the next gig. And it was their self-motivated, self operated, which very much appealed to me. So I remembered this guy who had this charisma up in Newcastle and talked him into coming down to London to play in this group. Well, I didn't have a group. I had the name of the group. Come down, join this group. We're called The Police, and we got a tour, and I actually had managed to get like the support act on a punk tour. There was a support slot. An American group called Cherry Vanilla were coming over. They needed a bass player and a drummer and some equipment. So I did a deal with them where I would be the drummer. I got this great bass player. I hadn't even, you know, I'd been introduced to the guy, but I hardly, you know, I had some gear. So I got us a slot on their tour. So I was able to call Sting up and say, "Look, you know, you don't know me, but I got this group," and da-da-da-da-da-da, and talked him into coming down to London, which is something he had wanted to do anyway. He wanted, you know, he knew that he had gotten as far as he could go up in Newcastle. He had to come down to the big city, and he didn't know anybody down there. And here was somebody calling him up from London, offering him a gig.
If I may interject, a Yank calling him from London.
Well, which made it sound like it might even be from Hollywood, you know.
So along with the original guitarist, Henri Padovani, the Police were dispatched to record for the Copeland's own Illegal Record Syndicate, or IRS, label. The results were more akin to the Keystone Cops, according to Stuart. Sting, who had a family to support, was getting discouraged after relocating to London.
Just at the point when Sting couldn't handle this anymore, Andy came into our lives and pretty much rescued the group. Once again, there we were, starving in London, doing sessions, actually pretty much to make a living. And there was a guy called Michael Howlett who needed a bass player and a drummer. And so Sting and I showed up, and the guitarist on the session was Andy Summers. And we did the session, and the guy actually had a concert. And so we did the concert. The guy was short of material, so we played a couple of Police songs. And since that meant Andy learning a couple Police songs, after that, we were doing a gig in London, and Andy showed up, and he knew two Police songs, so he came and jammed with us. A couple days later, I was walking down Oxford Street in London and ran into him, and he pulled me into a cafe and said, "Look, you've got talent. I think you and Sting, you got something, and only problem is you got to get rid of that guitarist, and you got to hire me." And Andy at the time was a highfalutin session player. He was getting a lot of money from sessions. He had, like, you know, he did a session and he'd have a roadie carry in his amp. He was he'd been around. He'd played with Neil Sedaka, all kinds of. He'd done, you know, that's just one. He'd played with the Animals at some point. He'd played with Soft Machine. All these at the time big credentials. And I had to sit him down and say, "Look, Andy, it's just like the record company. You're not going to get any tour support. There's no management. I'm the management. I'm also the record company. I had my own record label, Illegal Records, which is how we, you know, made our records. And I had to give him this whole thing, but he persisted. He said, no, you don't understand. you've got to have me in this group. I've been a session player all my life. I'm sick of it. I want to play in a group. This is the group that I want to play in. Shut up. I'm in the group.
Roxanne, you don't have to put on the red light. Those days are over. You don't have to sell your body to the night. Roxanne.
From their first album in November 1978, that's the Sting composition Roxanne from Outlandos D'Amour by The Police. The simple pop song was infected with a catchy reggae beat on the verses. I asked drummer Stuart Copeland how The Police first became exposed to Jamaican music.
I actually landed on it by accident myself. I was a jock at my college radio station, and my gig was as MD, was to listen to all the records that came in. And one of these records came in was Bob Marley, and I didn't play it because I knew that no one else would like it. I tried it on a few people, and they'd say, "Yeah," but I kind of like this record, and I actually went out and bought it, and the second album as well. And I was the only me and my brother actually, who with whom I shared an apartment when I got back to England, were the only people I knew who listened to it. And at some point, I think in '77, Sting was having a Christmas party. He borrowed my stereo, because he didn't have one, and my record collection, which had this Bob Marley, the first two Wailers albums. I think one was Burning, and the other one was the one with Lively Up Yourself. Lively Up Yourself was the track, you know, that little, and Sting picked up on that, and like, suddenly he was talking Jamaican, he was playing Jamaican, he was everything, you know, like, suddenly that was the thing, and all of us as well, because I had tried to play those rhythms, but you can't play reggae on one instrument. Reggae only exists as a dialogue between two or more instruments. You know, you can play a blues drum beat. You can play a jazz drum beat. You can play a reggae drum beat, but it doesn't create reggae. In fact, it sounds like a lounge bossa nova when you try and play the drums without that guitar upbeat. It isn't what it is until you get that combination of this drum beat and that guitar rhythm in that interplay, or the bass, which is on the downbeat and leaving those big holes. And so, I mean, I never, you know, but suddenly there was like two or more white musicians who were interested in this stuff. that's sort of where that all began. And it's also great fun to play drums to, because suddenly you turn your drum set upside down and all kinds of new possibilities. You can invent. Every time I sat down to play some of this stuff, I would invent things I'd never heard before. And it was all just there. It was all like easy picking.
The second single from the Police debut in 1978, Outlandish D'Amour, the song called Can't Stand Losing You, which, like Roxanne, flopped on initial release, but eventually would reach number two in Britain on its second release the following summer of 1979. When we come back, Sting and Andy Summers of the Police join Stuart Copeland to recall their first American tour by station wagon. For this and your other favorite interviews, visit inthestudio.net. I'm Red Beard, and you're in the studio for Regatta de Blanc by the Police.
Welcome back. In the studio, and I'm Sting with Red Beard, and he still has it.
Thanks, Sting. I'm Red Beard. The summer of 1979, the tumblers started to click for the Police in England. Simultaneously with the re-released Can't Stand Losing You peaking at number two, the lads landed the headlining slot at the annual outdoor Reading Festival in front of 20,000 Brits. The Police would release their second album, Regatta de Blanc, in October 1979, and it quickly sailed to number one in the UK, propelled by back-to-back number one singles. From my interview in January 1980, here's Andy Summers of the Police.
When we started doing the Reading Festival, I mean, our real success started to snowball very quickly in England. We were very successful in Reading. And then we had a number one single. And then our new album, Regatta de Blanc, went in at number one and stayed there for 4 weeks. It stayed in the top five for 4 months. It was only kept out of the top position when it finally went out by sort of TV advertised albums like Greatest Hits Collections. But generally, our success in Britain has been absolutely phenomenal. All of us are in a state of siege from fans at home. And we're being incredibly touted in the British press at this point.
I've got a Rolling Stone here that's dated issue number 310 for February 7th, 1980. Mm-hmm. On the cover, Readers and Critics Awards, Best New Band, The Police.
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, I mean, it's obvious of what happened to us in England. But this country was the first country to pick up on us, actually. And then we sort of overtook it in England. But I think things are looking hotter and finally now in America than they ever have done, due to the sort of having two albums out, having a hit single here, and the sort of combined effects of touring and getting a lot of media exposure. We seem to be a band that the American press, of not the normal press, you know, other like Newsweek, seem to be interested in interviewing us because we seem to be the most popular English new wave band that's come to this country, and we seem to be a symbol of a new movement in music. So we're newsworthy apart from just being another band that's making good records.
Stop.
The Police from Regatta du Blanc, their second album, with Message in a Bottle. Both the song and the album went straight to number one in England. But the same powerful American radio consultants that had tried to discourage me from playing Roxanne a year earlier were downplaying Regatta du Blanc's UK number one sales as less than meaningful in the States. In my January 1980 interview, you can hear slight puzzlement from first Andy Summers, followed by Sting of The Police.
Phenomenally well in Europe. I mean, okay. In England, it was number one for 3 or 4 weeks. Sold over 700,000 singles there. Number one in Holland, too. It's doing very well in Germany now and France. Everywhere, really.
Surprising that it wasn't a hit in America, actually. You thought
it got in the top 50, I think, just in America. Personally, I was a bit disappointed that it didn't go much better. I thought it was going to really do it for us over here, but I think it's almost just a little bit too sophisticated or a little bit too jangly for American airwaves on the general scheme of things, not the hipper stations like this one, of course. You know, so it did well in various areas, but it didn't do well enough nationally to... But I agree, I think it was the best... For me, it's my favourite track that we've ever recorded. I really think it's a great Police track.
No, you know, I think to have a hit single in America, singles have to obey a formula. And I don't think Message in the Bottle particularly fitted that formula. I agree. But, I mean, that's no reason for us to be disheartened because, if anything, it makes us more unique.
The Police were determined to cross their European success over to the United States. Using SWAT team tactics, they played 23 dates in 27 days at $200 a gig. They humped their own gear. They took turns driving the van hundreds of miles, and they shared cheap motel rooms. The night of the 1980 interview, the Police sold out a small Memphis club, played a full show, then turned the house to a new capacity crowd and played a second complete show, all the while a national TV crew videotaped the event. Here's Police founder Stuart Copeland.
When we first came to America, the record company didn't even know that we were on the label. We just showed up. We said, we're here, we're playing, we're on tour. You know, we just thought we'd inform you that we're in town. They say, who signed you? We were signed by the English record company, and the American branch knew nothing of it. My brother Ian, who was our agent, he had an agency in New York, and he called them up and said that they were coming over, and they said, but look, Ian, we're not going to be giving them tour support, we're not going to be doing this, and we're not gonna, it was like a list of what they were not going to do for us.
What's left?
Yeah, so we just came over anyway, and there was only three of us in a roadie, so, you know, it's two hotel rooms and a station wagon, and it was, you know, we didn't need any of their stuff.
Just another day.
the second Police album, Regatta de Blanc. That's the hypnotic, atmospheric Bring on the Night. Up next, Sting, Stuart Copeland, and Andy Summers all reconvene to examine their quantum leap forward in songwriting, in sound, and sales on their way to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. For this and your other favorite interviews, visit inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with the Police, Regatta de Blanc.
Welcome back. In the studio with the Police, I'm Stuart Copeland with Redbeard.
Thanks, Stuart. It's the anniversary of their second breakthrough album, Regatta de Blanc. Just 3 months after release, I asked how the Police had made such an overall improved sound on their sophomore effort, Regatta de Blanc. Sting, followed by Andy Summers, was quick to explain.
We're a better group than we were that when we made Outlandish Amour. Outlandish Amour has a kind of grotesque, naive charm about it, which is great, but Regatta de Blanc is infinitely a better record.
I agree.
Maybe we could record Outlandish Amour again and make advances on it. I'm sure we could. We could improve it beyond belief. It's just that we were not so good then.
We were discussing this last night. Just give you a name. There's a guy called Roy Thomas Baker who's producing a lot of very well-known groups now, and they're all tending to sound the same. It's an example of bringing an outside producer. And we've got a sound of our own now that definitely has something to do with the fact there's just the three of us in the studio, no outside producers laying any trips on us or extra sophisticated recording techniques that we may not know about. I mean, if we were to bring in somebody like that guy now, it could change our sound completely. And part of our success has to do with the sound and the way we've recorded, whether it's crude or not. You know, it is successful and it appeals to us primarily. So it could be dangerous for us to bring in an outside producer.
You
reminiscent of Bob Dylan's Subterranean Homesick Blues on the Verses, there's The Police with It's All Right For You from 1979's Regatta de Blanc album. Independent self-production on the first two albums made it appear that The Police would settle for cult status rather than reach for the brass ring of mass U.S. popularity. But listen carefully to what the two British members of The Police told me during the American Regatta de Blanc club tour. First Andy Summers, then Sting weighs in.
One thing that you could say about this country, actually, I think, is there's a sort of reversal of terms here, and that is that success is more the art over here than making records. And it's, I mean, this country, success and high achieving have high priority in all areas of life. I mean, people are brought up with that kind of thing, and it probably, I think it infiltrates into the musical world. Musicians all over the country are affected by it. See, those sort of considerations have always been outside the band. The most we can do is to follow our own path and to play music that we feel right. Because if you go on stage or you try and make records that aren't really the way you feel about music, there is always a false note there, and eventually it translates to an audience. And ironically, it loses its commerciality for that very same reason. In our case, we've never had to compromise ourselves musically. We've done what we felt right. Sting is a great songwriter, and he's written some very commercial songs, but he never set out to write commercial songs. That's the way they've come out and the way we've played them, and it's turned out to be a commercial success, not only down to the music as well, but also as well to our timing and to the image of the band and a combination of things. But the main thing for us is to be free musically and not to have to adhere to successful formulas that we may have unwittingly created in the past. We want to go on enjoying it, you know, and to start having to slaver to record company policies or commercial formulas is not the way I want to live my life.
I think we're talking hypothetically here, and I think The Police will eventually make it big in America. I'm very confident of it because we're so determined to do it. However, if we take this hypothesis further to say that there is going to be the schism between British rock and what's big there in American rock, then as a songwriter and a performer, I'd be interested, purely from an experimental point of view, to change our music to see what would be a hit. It interests me as a songwriter to find out what people get off on. I could actually do it. I could compromise our music to such an extent that it might be a hit in America. I could see ways of doing it, but the fact is we don't. The fact is we want to stay as we are, and we'll do it in our own, on our own terms. We'll be right back.
Walking on the Moon from The Police and their 1979 second album is probably the song that convinced me of the potency of the band and the long-term star power of singer and composer Sting. Years after Regatta de Blanc, stardom, wealth, Grammy Awards, and now the third highest grossing tour in history, Sting, in particular, appreciates the validation as a songwriter.
It's a nice feeling. It's a very confirming feeling, you know. I did a Saturday Night Live with Dana Carvey, and I'm standing in an elevator. I'm playing myself, you know. He gets in and starts to sing Roxanne at me. You know?
In a suit. Yeah.
In a suit. And this, this is not a sketch. This is my life. People do this all the time. They sing to me. And I think that's wonderful for a popular songwriter to have reached a lot of people unconsciously. It's something I wrote in the living room, you know, with a dog at my feet, you know, just to amuse myself. It's now a song on, that people can dredge from their memories and bring up. You know, it's there. It's in people's psyches. And I think that's great. I'm very privileged to be a songwriter. It's a great feeling. Don't let anybody tell you different.